Ayatollah Khamenei highlights the significance of the elections in the country and warns against the enemy's plots to create rifts between people and the Islamic establishment. Iran marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Thousands of people stage a rally in the northern Yemeni city of Sa'da to slam policies of the U.S. and its allies in the region. Welcome to the program. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has warned against the enemy's attempts to create rifts between the Iranian people and the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was addressing the nation on the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of Iran's Islamic Republic's founder, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei highlighted the significance of elections in Iran. He stressed that Imam Khomeini viewed elections as the manifestation of people's will and stood firm against hegemony and corruption. Ayatollah Khamenei also referred to the upcoming presidential vote. He said, "The existing shortcomings should not discourage people from having political participation." The leader also recommended that people consider deeds rather than words of the presidential hopefuls and urged the candidates to avoid making hollow promises. He urged influential figures to encourage people to participate in the election. Friday marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing of the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. The following report takes a look at his life and his ideology.
Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, better known as Imam Khomeini, was born on the 24th of September 1902 in central Iran. He studied to become a religious scholar and in 1963 became a marja, the highest religious authority in Shia Islam. Imam Khomeini was an outspoken critic of the Pahlavi regime that ruled Iran before the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, he was arrested by the regime security service for his anti-Shah speeches. In 1964, Imam Khomeini was sent to exile, living in Turkey, Iraq, and then France, from where he urged his supporters to overthrow the Shah. On February 1, 1979, he returned to Iran, and 10 days later, the Pahlavi monarchy collapsed. Imam Khomeini believed that Iran should strive towards self-reliance. He viewed certain elements of the Western culture as inherently decadent that have a corrupting influence upon the youth. His ultimate vision was for Islamic nations to converge into a single unified power in order to avoid alignment with either the West or the East, and he believed that this would happen at some point in the future. Imam Khomeini intended to reconstruct Muslim unity and solidarity, so he declared the birth week of Prophet of Islam as the Unity Week. He then declared the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as the International Votes Day. Imam Khomeini was among the world's top leaders to influence boycotts against Israel, starting in 1967. After the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arabs began, he called any relationship with Israel haram or religiously prohibited. This message was, in a way, the initiative that led to pervasive boycott Israel campaigns. The Iranian charismatic leader has been praised by many prominent international figures.
The thoughts and ideology of Imam Khomeini transcend barriers of time and place. He has left long-lasting impressions on the world history.
Imam Khomeini was not only a great leader for the Iranian people, but also a leader for all the freedom movements across the globe.
Imam Khomeini's influence on the world's affair was so much that even some of his enemies praised him.
Ayatollah Khomeini, through a well-thought-out plan, created crisis in the Western world. He made plans with such a lightning speed that political analysts and leaders had no time to make counterplans. Nobody could foresee the Imam Khomeini's decisions.
Imam Khomeini passed away in June 1989 at the age of 87. More than three decades after his passing, the Islamic Republic of Iran continues his school of thought in support for resistance against oppression.
Although the United States, or I should say the United States, has imposed many rounds of sanctions against Iran, many of these anti-Iran measures were imposed by former President Donald Trump, who was very close to the sworn enemy of Iran, Israel. Before coming into office, his successor pledged to change course regarding Iran, but that pledge remains to be fulfilled. Take a look.
Commodities traders in the United States came across something surprising last week when the U.S. Energy Information Agency released its new figures. The EIA figures included Iranian crude oil for the first time in decades. The government statistics and court documents show the U.S. has sold about 2 million barrels of Iranian crude after seizing an oil tanker off the coasts of the United Arab Emirates. American authorities say they brought the Liberian-flagged tanker Achilles to Houston, Texas in March. It was ordered to discharge its cargo at the port of Galveston. The crude from the oil vessel, which the U.S. says was transporting Iranian oil, was then sold for $110 million. American officials say the tanker was covertly transporting the cargo to China in violation of U.S. sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. U.S. court documents also allege the vessel was subject to forfeiture under American anti-terrorism statutes. Some observers have described the seizure as illegal under international law and argue that it amounts to piracy.
I mean, it's piracy, it's theft. It's amazing that the United States can appropriate to itself the right to do such things. This exceeds even, you know, the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was a cruel empire within its boundaries, but it couldn't go outside of its boundaries and tell the rest of the world what to do.
Anti-Iran hawk former U.S. President Donald Trump has been gone for months now, but the United States has kept up its anti-Iran policies under Democratic President Joe Biden.
As I mentioned, although the United States, or I should say the U.S., has imposed many rounds of sanctions against Iran, many of these anti-Iran measures were imposed by former President Donald Trump, who was, by the way, very close to Iran's sworn enemy, Israel. Now, before coming to office, his successor pledged to change course regarding Iran, but that pledge, as I mentioned, remains to be fulfilled. Take a look.
The recent seizure of the oil tanker was a stark reminder that America's anti-Iran measures are not ending. Many such measures were reimposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who abandoned the hard-earned 2015 Iran nuclear deal. His successor, Joe Biden, says sanctions are not exactly his favorite, but the anti-Iran measures are being fully enforced under his watch. The Islamic Republic's oil shipping and banking are among the sectors targeted by America's unilateral sanctions. Iran has repeatedly described America's measures as economic war. The American sanction mechanism has made it extremely difficult for Iran to purchase some essential goods like medicines. The American president promised a shift in U.S. policy on Iran, but he has so far failed to fulfill his pledge to change course.
As far as its foreign policy goes, this is truly the neocon foreign policy. These are the actors from the Obama administration, people who had key roles when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, like Campbell and Sullivan, people who are now in these critical positions inside the administration, and Samantha Power at AID, and so on and so forth, who really were able to impose the most terrible sanctions on Iran.
The United States and Iran say they are willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held several rounds of talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the half-dead nuclear deal. Diplomats from the United States have been present in Vienna and talking with their P4+1 counterparts. There have been some signs of progress in Vienna, raising hopes for a revival of the international nuclear agreement. But critics believe that even if the U.S. returns to the deal, past experience shows that there is no guarantee that the U.S. will honor its commitments in the future.
The Yemeni people have rallied in the northern city of Sa'ada in a show of resistance against their enemies. Demonstrators chanted slogans and slammed policies of the U.S. and its allies against nations in the region. They also expressed sympathy with the people of Gaza that was hit by 11 days of Israeli attacks last month. The Yemenis condemned the Israeli killing of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. In her final statement, the Yemeni protesters called on all Muslim nations to boycott American and Israeli products as part of efforts to resist their aggressive policies. The statement also called on the Yemeni people to stand against aggressors. Now, China has accused the U.S. of, quote, suppressing its firms after Washington blacklisted more Chinese companies. Beijing has urged Washington to respect market law and principles. It also promised retaliation if the ban remains. On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden added 28 Chinese companies to a list of firms that American entities are prevented from investing in. The list already contained 31 companies, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, had blacklisted. Washington accuses all these companies of having links with China's defense or surveillance technology sectors. The ban has been among the issues of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past year. And now, foreign ministers of Pakistan, Afghanistan, and China have held a trilateral meeting to discuss the current situation in Afghanistan. The meeting comes against the backdrop of fears of possible civil war in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the war-torn country. Kamran Youssef has the details.
As Afghanistan faces an uncertain future, the foreign minister of Afghanistan joined his Pakistani and Chinese counterpart to discuss the way forward. The trilateral meeting is seen as part of efforts seeking a political solution to the Afghan conflict. The three countries have agreed that there is no military solution to the Afghan war, and hence the best way forward is to seek a political settlement. But the chances of such a peace deal appear grim. This has led the Pakistani Prime Minister to express concerns that Afghanistan may slip into another phase of civil war.
Peaceful settlement day.
If there is no political settlement after the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan, we fear that Afghanistan may face the same situation as it had after Soviet withdrawal.
After the Soviet withdrawal in 1989, Afghanistan had descended into a civil war that eventually brought the Afghan Taliban to power. The U.S. has accelerated its troops withdrawal and may pull out its last soldier from Afghanistan on July 4 instead of September 11. Observers believe that it appears that the U.S. is running from Afghanistan.
Some are calling these hasty decisions. Obviously, such decisions have been taken after long thought, because the American administration for long thought that the results they wanted to achieve could not achieve. So they left with no choice but to leave Afghanistan.
As the U.S. already pulled out 44% of its remaining troops, there is no indication of any political settlement in Afghanistan.
Pakistan and other regional countries have long feared that the U.S. may leave Afghanistan in a mess. And the situation on the ground suggests those fears are now turning into reality. The worry is that the instability in Afghanistan will undermine the security of its neighboring countries. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
India has logged over 132,000 new COVID infections in 24 hours, raising its total caseload to over 28.6 million. The Indian Health Ministry also confirmed more than 2,700 new deaths for the past 24 hours. Latest figure pushes the country's death toll from the virus to over 340,000. India has the world's second largest COVID caseload after the U.S. The South Asian country's case tally jumped after infections began to rise in February. They reached their daily peak of over 414,000 on May the 6th. Now, daily cases are witnessing a downward trend as a vaccination program goes on. So far, more than 3% of the population in India has been fully vaccinated. Iran has reported 155 more COVID-19 fatalities in 24 hours, raising the overall death toll to around 81,000. The health ministry also reported over 9,000 new infections in the past day, bringing the total caseload to over 2.95 million. Nearly 2.5 million have so far been recovered from the disease. The government imposed strict nationwide restrictions in April following a surge in infections and deaths. Iran has launched its national vaccination campaign in early February. More than 4.1 million people have so far received the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine worldwide. Over 530,000 people have been fully vaccinated against the deadly virus. Colombia has reported a double record of daily deaths and infections of COVID-19 as most Latin American countries are struggling to contain the pandemic. Colombia registered 545 new fatalities and more than 28,000 daily cases. The country's death toll has now passed 90,000. Brazil registered more than 1,600 new fatalities, bringing its total to almost 470,000. That is the second highest in the world after the U.S. Mexico also reported more than 200 daily deaths, bringing the overall number to more than 228,000. Separate government data recently published suggest the actual death toll in the country is at least 60% above the confirmed figure.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In his speech on the anniversary of the passing of Imam Khomeini on the 3rd of June, 2020, Ayatollah Khamenei spoke about the transformations which Imam Khomeini brought about in Iran and the Iranian nation. Transforming people's outlook about the future and creation of modern Islamic civilization. Another transformation was changing the people's mentality about the future. During the time when revolutionary activities began and when Imam entered the arena, despite the slogans that some parties, groups, and individuals, which were very limited and small in number, chanted, the people did not see a future. They did not envisage a future ahead of them that gave to the creation of the new Islamic civilization. If you look at the Iranian nation today, you see the blessed hands of Imam as the architect of this condition. The people are looking towards creating a new Islamic civilization, forging a great Islamic alliance and establishing the Islamic Ummah. In the present time, this is the outlook of the masses of the people. Transforming people's attitude towards the young generation and trusting them. Another area of transformation that Imam brought about was a change in the outlook towards youth. He trusted the thoughts and actions of the youth. That was a transformation in the true sense of the word. For example, when the Islamic Revolution, God's Corps, was formed, he placed 20-plus-year-old youth at the top of this organization. They were youth who were at most 30 years old. They were top of the God's Corps, and they were commanders and generals. Those youths were entrusted with big tasks. The same was true of other areas. He had astonishing trust in the youth whom he believed in, and he gave them responsibilities in the judiciary and other areas. He assigned them different roles, and he trusted their thoughts and their actions. Transforming people's viewpoint about world powers and believing in the possibility of their defeat. At that time, before the Islamic Revolution, no one believed that one could say something different from what the US said and do something different from what the US did. However, Imam acted in a way that US presidents admitted that Khomeini humiliated us. And that was the truth of the matter.
We are on the side of the oppressed, whichever pole they may be in. Palestinians are oppressed by the Israelis, therefore we side with them. This is one of many quotes of late Imam Ruhullah Musawi Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Approaching the 32nd passing anniversary of Imam Khomeini, remember his efforts in warning the Islamic world to the dangers of the creation of the usurping Israeli entity. There is no doubt that Al-Quds al-Sharif holds a prodigious position in the hearts and minds of monotheistic religions in general, and among Muslims in particular, due to the religious sanctities that this city contains, such as the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock, In addition to that, it was the first Qibla to which Muslims prayed before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, converted the Qibla to the holy Kaaba in the city of Mecca. Accordingly, there is no disagreement or conflict between the people of all religions over its sanctity and high status. Muslims continued to make pilgrimage to it just like they did to the holy Kaaba until the Zionist entity seized the holy city of Al-Quds entirely in 1967 and became an obstacle prohibiting Muslims from reaching their holy city. As such, Imam Khomeini, since the establishment of the usurper entity, tried to alert the Islamic world to the danger of that entity, not only to Jerusalem and Palestine that it had occupied, but to all our Arab and Islamic world. His Eminence worked to establish a true Islamic awareness to link Muslims with Al-Quds and Palestine so that Jerusalem would become an issue in the mind, heart, moral, spiritual, and missionary entity of every Muslim, making said Muslims a barrier of defense and resistance against Zionist gangs that occupied it after it had occupied most of Palestine and expelled its people. Palestine took the lion's share in Imam Khomeini's speeches, making all Muslims bear the responsibility to defend their faithful cause, as global Zionism aims from the occupation of Palestine to control the capabilities of the Islamic world and humiliate it. Therefore, liberating Palestine implies getting rid of a major terrorist plot, and this is exactly what Imam Khomeini's legacy towards Palestine presents. It presents the foundation of a renaissance project to confront the great danger of Zionism expansion in West Asia. Welcome to the Middle Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Statements of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini reveals that the Palestinian cause occupied an advanced position in the principles and interests of the late Imam. He promised us that we will see Palestine liberated and that the Israelis will be expelled from our region with the firm determination of the people of this region. Imam Khomeini made it clear that we will expel the Zionists who are still displacing and killing our children and aspiring to expand in our land in all of our region. Since the early 1960s, late Imam Khomeini began his long struggle against imperialism and Zionism, making Palestine the Arab and Muslim central cause and its liberation the top priority. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, producer and creative director at Islamic Pulse. Thank you very much for being with us, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar. Starting with Imam Ruhullah's struggles through the world, the sermons, the meetings, the speeches that he delivered, he used to conduct in various places in all times. He always mentioned Palestine, made it a central cause for him and a top priority as well for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you explain the effect of Imam's words on the awakening of the Muslim Ummah?
The Imam certainly had a profound impact on all Muslims. Oftentimes we make the mistake of relegating Imam Khomeini as just a Shia leader. But this is not the case. The reality is that when the Islamic Revolution had begun and there were people on the streets of Iran and they were chanting slogans and they were saying that we neither want the East nor do we want the West, we want Islam, Islam, it was not just Shias, it was Sunnis too. In fact, it was not just Iranians. Across the region, the Islamic region, all the Muslim countries pretty much, there were people on the streets too. There were people who were starting to chime those very same sentiments. That revolutionary spirit exploded out of Iran and it spread across the region. Now, you can imagine, at that time, there were two superpowers in the world. There was America in the West, and there was the Soviet Union in the East. These two superpowers wished to control the minds and the pockets of the Muslims across the region. And so when they saw that Sunnis and Shias are all proclaiming that they wish to bring about a revolution and bring about an Islamic Republic, just like they're bringing into Iran, those superpowers became very intimidated. It shook the world. And again, I have to emphasize this point. It was not just Shias who were inspired by Imam Khomeini's words. I'll give you an example. One of the most prominent speakers in the Sunni world is Ahmadinejad. Many people will recognize him as being the teacher of Zakir Naik. Now, Ahmadinejad, he would often speak with the Christians and the Jews, and he would debate with them. What does Ahmadinejad say? And many of you will have seen this clip, and it's available online, where he says, I went to Iran, and I witnessed Imam Khomeini with my own eyes. And I don't know what it is about the man, but when I see him, my eyes just started to overflow with tears. Mm-hmm. Remember, this is Ahmadinejad, a Sunni speaker. Mm-hmm. And then he says that everything about the man was Quran. He says it's just Quran. He was emanating the Quran in his words, in his actions. You see, the Quran is a unifying phenomenon. It is common, whichever school of thought you may belong to, the Quran is the universally understood and accepted immaculate word of God. And so Imam Khomeini had completely amalgamated himself into this divine book.
Well, now, Sheikh Haidar, this is very interesting, but fast forward to what's happening, especially in the last couple of days with the normalization ties with the Israeli entity happening. We did hear back in the day Imam Khomeini viewing the Israeli entity with suspicion and repeating his warnings to the entire world, not only to the regional, to the Islamic Ummah in the region, but he kept saying that the Zionists will try and subordinate their presence across all of the region and probably the rest of the world. Can you tell me what do you think his thoughts and his teachings, how do you think that collided with last year's normalization with the entity by a number of Arab states?
Well, it's actually very fascinating, sister, because if you look at the philosophy of Imam Khomeini, he not only had this unifying philosophy, but he also had a staunch stance against the Zionist entity of Israel. And if I'm correct, he even stated that, look, with America even, we can have diplomacy. There is a chance that we can have talks with America, provided that they change some of their policies, even though America is the great Satan, according to the words of Imam Khomeini. However, when it came to the Zionist entity of Israel, there was no space for any diplomacy, because Imam Khomeini was very clear and very explicit. Israel is a cancer. Well, the cancer is a cancer. It is not a country. It's not a normal nation that can be discussed with, traded with, have an embassy for. No. Israel is that despicable entity which has usurped the lands of Muslims. They don't actually, these Zionists don't belong there at all. This was the philosophy of Imam Khomeini. Very simple and very easy to understand. And so we saw that many Sunnis, many Shiites came on board with that mission and that overall perspective. And when we see that these Arab so-called Muslim governments are normalizing ties with the Zionist entity, it's a tragedy. And what they've essentially done is they have betrayed Imam Khomeini. What did Imam Khomeini stand for? He stood for Islam. He stood for the Quran. These so-called Muslim governments out there have actually betrayed the ethos of the Quran. And with your permission, I'd like to recite a verse of the Quran because it highlights exactly what we're talking about here.
But
it says very...
The magnificent effort of the resistance, though, slowed down this normalization process, actually put a hurdle in this process in the Arab world, because people in the Arab world are against it even before it was announced. But now, after Palestine, what happened to Gaza and how Gaza retaliated with this magnificent power against the Zionist entity, why did it take blood, though, for to be shed by the Palestinians, for these Arabs living in those states to understand that it's important for them to be vocal about their stances?
You're absolutely right. It's a huge shame, actually, that it took this amount of bloodshed before these Arab nations, maybe they start to recognize it now. But look, it was about this verse of the Quran, in tanṣurū Allāha yanṣurkum wa yuthabbit aqdāmakum. If you help Allah, Allah will help you, and He will make firm your feet. The resistance, the unified resistance of the noble Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, showed the world. It shook the world again, because it showed that Israel, with all of their military might and all of their backing from America and the other world powers, could not stand against a unified effort from the Palestinians. And so what this did is it had repercussions upon those so-called Arab nations. And what's happening is we saw that there was public support. This public support should not be underestimated, mm-hmm. not just in the Muslim world, but across the world. You saw it yourself, sister, in the UK, in the United States, in Australia, in every country in the world pretty much. We saw that there were united efforts from Muslims and non-Muslims alike standing up.
But there is one question in my mind, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, about Iran is obviously not the only Muslim country that supports Palestine and the right of a return and the right for liberation. We have other states, for example, like Turkey. But we all hear, all that we hear coming from Turkey, for example, are words. Why did they not adopt the approach that is brought upon by the teachings of Imam Khomeini to at least ensure that resistance can defend itself by itself?
Well, it requires an essay answer, but to keep it short and simple, sister, it requires faith. When we're talking about Imam Khomeini, often people relegate him to just the arena of politics. No, this was a man of faith, and his politics was the divine politics of the prophets and awliya. It requires faith, and not every country, and not most people, it's very difficult to adopt that faith. Look, when Imam Khomeini comes out and says, if every Muslim in the world was to throw a bucket of water at the Zionist entity, it would just flood, it would wash away. Now, it requires faith to believe in that, and I feel that that is the main trait that was missing. Another thing is this idea of the world. People get bribed, they get drawn towards this materialistic dunya. And so Turkey, a nation like Turkey, you often see the sentiments of Turkey wishing to be associated with the Europeans. They want this kind of image for themselves. And so it never allows them to get off the fence and properly support the oppressed people of Palestine. Mm-hmm. When Imam Khomeini, you know, he said to the people that, look, if they threaten us, if the enemies threaten us with sanctions, then we are the children of Ramadan. And if they threaten us with physically attacking us, then we are the children of Muharram. Mm-hmm. Faith is really the missing ingredient. If anybody truly wishes to support the oppressed Palestinian cause and any oppressed in the world, you need to have faith. And that's what Imam Khomeini gave to the people of Iran and the region. I don't think Turkey, the governor of Turkey, actually understood that message. They'd be in a different place right now if they had.
I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidar, Creative Director at Islamic Pulse, for joining us to talk about this very important matter. It's not enough for me. I need more time to talk to you. This is such an important matter, and what you said is absolutely amazing, and it's much needed to be heard on TV for people to hear it, especially the teachings of Imam Ruhullah Khomeini. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the UN Human Rights Council decided to open an investigation into the war crimes on the Palestinian people.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The UN Human Rights Council decided on Thursday to create an open-ended international investigation into violations surrounding the latest Israeli aggression against Gaza, accusing Israel of systematic abuses in the Palestinian territories and inside Israeli-occupied cities as well. UN officials said they saw no evidence that civilian buildings in Gaza hit by Israeli fighter jets were being used for any military purposes to begin with. Rather, the aggression was disproportionate and might constitute war crimes. More on this following report.
It did not take long after the end of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, in which the Israeli entity committed war crimes against Palestinian civilians, until the Human Rights Council voted to establish an independent international investigation committee to investigate the Israeli aggression and to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and international human rights law, in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, and within the 1948 territories. The resolution was adopted in the Council after its draft was presented by Pakistan, with 24 countries voting for it, 14 abstaining, and 9 opposing, namely Uruguay, Britain, Austria, Germany, Marshall Islands, Malawi, Bulgaria, Cameroon, and the Czech Republic. On the other hand, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs responded by noting that it had previously boycotted the United Nations fact-finding mission in 2009, and that it also now rejects the decision, stressing that it would not cooperate with the investigation. The United States of America also expressed deep regret at the decision of the Human Rights Council, claiming this resolution threatens to obstruct the current progress in the region, citing the humiliating normalization attempts by irrelevant puppet Arab states. What is important about this decision is that for the first time, a permanent rather than a temporary one-year investigation committee will be formed, and at an international level, to examine the Israeli violations against the Palestinians in the 1948 occupied territories as well. It is also important because it represents the first time that the Human Rights Council addresses the root causes of the systematic Israeli racial discrimination against the native Palestinian people in occupied Palestinian territories of 1967. Meanwhile, a number of Palestinian human rights institutions are preparing to submit requests for an international investigation into war crimes and violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law committed by the Israeli occupation forces during the last battle, in addition to requests that will be directed to European countries to put officials in the occupation army on trial for their responsibility for killing civilians in Gaza.
To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Eva Bartlett, independent journalist who has lived in Gaza before. Thank you for being with us, Eva, in this segment about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Now, Israel targeted several residential areas in Gaza, killing civilians, killing actually more than 200 civilians, half of whom were children, as you may know. However, this is not the first time that they do that inside of Gaza. Yet, it is the first time that the UNSC dared to declare this aggression as a possible war crime and took vote to begin an investigation in Gaza and elsewhere in the 1948 and 1967 Palestinian territories. What was it this time that pushed the UN to actually do this?
Well, for example, when I was in Gaza during the 2008-2009 massacre, it wasn't easy to get the news out about the Israeli war crimes that Israel is committing. So for example, I would document something and then rush back to one of the media buildings to then try to get it out to the world. But, you know, a decade later, more people in Gaza have access to smartphones and to internet, so they can live stream, they can document in real time Israel's war crimes. And there are many Palestinians in Gaza who have done that in previous wars and in this last war. So therefore, the UN can't ignore it anymore. You know, previously it was easy for them to say, well, we're not sure what's going on, but when you have so many people documenting the manifold Israeli war crimes, then people around the world also are seeing it and are horrified by what's going on. So I think it's the combination of Palestinians having the technology to document themselves Israel's war crimes, and then that documentation getting out as it's happening.
Well, Eva, you lived in Gaza during Israel's incremental genocide against the people of the native Palestinians in Gaza in 2009 and in 2012 as well, and you've witnessed the tactics with your own eyes. Can you maybe unfold some of the tragic incidents that you witnessed as an independent journalist, which definitely amounts to a war crime, especially against the media and medics inside of Gaza?
Absolutely. In the 2009 massacre of Gaza, I was among a handful of activists riding with the Palestinian Red Crescent in their ambulances, and I was mostly in northern Gaza, so I was seeing a very hard-hit area where Israel committed numerous war crimes, including using white phosphorus. And I know people are aware of the Hakura school, which Israel hit, with Palestinian internally displaced people that had fled from the areas that were either being occupied by the Israeli army or being bombed by the Israeli army. And they had fled to this UN school for which the Israelis had the coordinates, and yet Israel bombed that school. But I documented Israel's wide use of white phosphorus in Al-Atatra, which is in northern Gaza, in Gaza City itself, in the Zaytun area, in Sheikh Rajlin, and even on the rehabilitation center, the Wafa Rehabilitation Center in eastern Gaza. So the use of white phosphorus on a civilian population is a war crime. Israel's targeting medics is a war crime as well, and at least two medics I knew that were targeted. One was shot at with a dart bomb, a flechette bomb, as he stood in his uniform next to his ambulance, and he died as a result of the dart bomb that shredded him, and he went into shock and died. The other medic I was with, his name's Hassan, and we were in an ambulance going to pick up a corpse at the Isbid Abd Rabbo crossroads, and Hassan and Jamal, two medics also in uniforms, in and during ceasefire hours in which civilians and medics should be able to work without being targeted by Israeli snipers, they came under sniper fire and had to run for their lives, the sniper fire coming right up to the ambulance that I was in. So there's the issue of targeting medics, and thereby, by the way, targeting medics, they're preventing medics from reaching the civilians that desperately need aid, which is also against the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. But in terms of other Israeli war crimes, they point-blank assassinated children. There's the Isbid Abd Rabbo family, Khaled Abd Rabbo, his two children, ages 2 and 7, were point-blank assassinated by an Israeli soldier. A family that I met after the fact, their one-year-old daughter was point-blank, was targeted by an Israeli sniper. The Israelis rounded up entire and dozens of the Samuni clan in, I believe it was in Zaytun, outside the outskirts of Gaza City, rounded them up, put them in one home, and then bombed it.
Well, the level of horror.
And I'm sorry, Marwa, you did mention media buildings. Israel, as we know in this past war on Gaza, Israel targeted, I believe it was at least 3 high-rise media buildings,
mm-hmm.
One of which, the Shuruk building, the Israelis had targeted in 2009 when I was in the building, shelling it at least 7 times with, I believe it was either a tank or Apache fire.
Mm-hmm.
They also targeted it in 2012 and 2014, and then this last time they completely destroyed it,
yeah.
As they did the Jawhara Tower.
Yeah.
And we know that in doing so, clearly this was because they wanted to try as much as they could to prevent Palestinian journalists from documenting what would be many war crimes to follow.
Ava, one of the incidents you once told me about, we were chatting about this issue, and you told me about when Israeli occupation forces opened fire at farmers in Gaza, and you were actually there, but thank God you were not hurt. Could you tell us more about maybe the testimonies briefly about such incidents that the people of Gaza endure while they are being besieged by the Israeli entity?
Yeah, this is a particularly sadistic aspect of the siege on Gaza. They, as we know, they prevent Palestinians from importing or exporting, which is decimating their economy. But then they prevent them from fishing and farming by targeting fishers and farmers with heavy machine gun fire. In the case of fishers, even targeting them with missiles, abducting them, taking their boats and not returning them. In the case of farmers, over the course of the 3 years that I was living in Gaza, I and other activists were accompanying farmers on their land, which was usually 500 or 600 meters from the fence encircling Gaza, encaging Gaza. And Israelis say that the 300 meters on the Gaza side of that fence is a no-go zone in which Palestinians, if they dare to tread, will be arrested or shot dead, usually the latter.
Even if they are farmers.
Yes, these are farmers. You can see quite clearly they are unarmed. They are clearly farmers. And these include not only just young men of labor, young laborers, but also children and elderly, entire families working on their land. The Israeli jeeps will either shoot at them from, the Israeli soldiers will either get out of jeeps and shoot at them, or they'll use a remote-controlled gun tower.
Well, Ava, in a minute or less than that, we also saw the Israeli war crimes, not only in the enclaved Gaza Strip, but also in the 1948 and 1967 occupied territories inside of Palestine, like, for example, Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where a number of families are facing imminent forced displacement by the occupation. But we also saw harmony between the internal Palestinian, occupied Palestinian land and Gaza. Do you think that this experience of unity can actually be built upon for the future of Palestine?
Yeah, it was a historic time because, as we know, there are various factors that have created division amongst Palestinians. I would say, first and foremost, the occupation, the physical occupation, keeping Palestinians apart from one another, but also other divisive means of keeping Palestinians not unified. But what we saw recently with all the resistance factions unifying and sending a very strong message to Israel that they are standing with the Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and with Al-Quds, of course, this was rather unprecedented, and I think that this is a powerful message to their occupiers, but the game has changed. They can no longer kill wantonly and displace Palestinians wantonly. They will pay a price.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Eva Bartlett, independent journalist who had a very immense and deep experience of the occupation and the genocide inside of Gaza, for joining us to talk about the Israeli war crimes against the people of Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us, Eva.
Thank you.
Please do stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's segment of Back to Reality, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have the pleasure of hosting two wonderful guests. I'll leave the introduction to themselves.
I'm Muzaffar Haider, at your service today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for joining us.
And I'm Hasnain Ali. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa
barakatuh. Alaikum wa rahmatullah. In memory of the great, I would like to think of him as the great scholar and mystic, Ayatollah Ruhullah al-Musawi al-Khomeini. Brother Muzaffar, when you hear that name, Khomeini, what's the first thought that comes to your mind?
One of the most inspirational things that I heard about Imam Khomeini when I was only a kid was when he had accomplished the revolution, you know, all these crowds are coming out, that, you know, he puts one hand up in the air and the crowds just go wild. I mean Westerners will be familiar with rock concerts and celebrities and stuff. Hey man, that is nothing compared to the love that surrounded this man. They are willing to give their lives for him. So somebody comes to Imam Khomeini and they say, all these people love you so much, they're in love with you. And how does that make you feel? Imam Khomeini says, well, nothing really. Then he said, what do you mean? So Imam Khomeini says, look, if the people love me for what I'm saying, I'm still going to say it. And if they hate me for what I'm saying, I'm still going to say it, because it's the truth. He didn't live his life for people or for money or for politics or for any other reason except for Allah. Except for Allah.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن ملقود.
That's another quality about Imam Khomeini that I admire so much, and I feel like even as youth we can incorporate into our lives, the amount of ikhlas, the sincerity that he had in every action, right? And like, he trusted in God so much, and that's the only thing that kept him going despite all the odds.
Right.
They were trying to kill him, they arrested him, they exiled him, they threatened his family. But he was so sure that this is the words of Allah that I need to carry out. I need to do this for these Muslim people.
So I just remember that Imam Khomeini was really fond of kids.
He was.
Yeah, so like Imam Khomeini, like, he was a serious man. He was a man of his words. He was a man of the principles. So when we talk to his family members, we get to know he was a good man. Like
in
that.
The house, his face changed.
Exactly.
Man, that frown
every picture you see with his grandkids, he has this the slight smile, even an ear-to-ear with his children. Exactly.
You know, doing all this work for Islam, he still used to go to his house and he used to sit with his family members and listen to their issues. Mm. And, you know, once when, you know, usually the granddaughters used to visit him, then he used to ask, like, where's your child? Then the I was reading this conversation, like, between Imam Khomeini and his granddaughter. So he asked him, like, where's your child? He's like, I didn't get him because I thought, like, you'll get disturbed. So, like, I'm disturbed by this, that you did not get him.
Remember once he had guests and he rolled up his sleeves and started washing the dishes.
That's beautiful. This man is probably, like, one of the most well-known personalities of modern era, I guess. But then he's like, he didn't feel like, oh, but I'm such an important person now, you know? Exactly. What am I going to do, wash dishes for you, dude? No. And when we were talking about his relationship with his family members, did you guys know that he actually wrote poetry for his daughter-in-law? Her name was Fatime. Her name is Dr. Fatime Tabatabai, and wrote poetry for her. That's how well he vibed with his family
members.
That's
so beautiful, yeah.
And it just, it reminds me of Rasulullah. I can't help it. Every aspect, almost every aspect of Imam Khomeini's characteristics and personality reminds me of Rasul, that multifaceted thing he's got going on.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha-Nabi wa alihi.
Here on Back to Reality with my two special guests, we're talking about the most distinguished, important, prominent and wonderful qualities and features of Imam Khomeini Ridwanullah Alayh. I want to talk more about, what do you guys think made Imam Khomeini the way he was? Let's start with the youngest.
Okay, so, you know, the love for God made him Imam Khomeini.
Mm, true.
You know, he had the love for God, and because he had the love for God, you know, he loved Haqq. He had that love for the truth. Yeah. So that made him Imam Khomeini, and, you know, being a servant of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, that he used to follow in the footsteps of the Aimma Athar alayhim salam. All his idea of establishing a Islamic Republic, you know, where did he learn from? Like, we have got plenty of ahadith, like Imams mentioning that, you know, we need to establish justice in the world. So he was, you know, this made him Imam Khomeini.
He had the practical steps that you need to take, and he also had those spiritual dimensions, and they came together. I mean, there's lots you can say about it. I mean, he had the most wonderful teachers. His teachers were the top caliber teachers in the entire world. He also had a good upbringing. He was also entered into the Hawza and religious environment at the beginning of his, like, when he was very young, right? He also, you know, familiarized himself a lot with the Quran. But, you know, one of his favorite verses that he would often recite is La yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa wus'aha. No soul is burdened with a burden except to the extent of its ability. And if we look at it, there are so many other people who have had precisely the same thing. They've had amazing teachers. They've gone to the Hawza from a young age. They were also in a scholarly environment. They also entered that scholarly environment for a young age, and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
There is still something that makes Imam Khomeini stand out, and he was completely distinguished. And if I really try hard to find that trait and that quality which made him the way he was, I would circle right back again to that love that he had for Allah, for that sincerity, for that absolute
love
faith
that he had for Allah, that led him, you know, the proper understanding from the religion. Like, he understood the religion properly, and, you know, he established the Wilayat al-Faqih and the Islamic government. You know, he understood the religion properly, and the words he used to mention, that Hasbunullah, that God is enough for us. That he said that we don't need to depend on anyone. Like, beat West, we can do everything. Like, that we can do anything, that God is enough for us. So he had that proper understanding from the religion.
Yes,
made
yes,
him alone.
He did. He did. He had a very deep and very thorough understanding, comprehension of the religion of Islam.
He had that sort of mind. He would pick things apart and try to understand them in depth.
He was
and that's
a genius,
why he was
yes.
so multifaceted. he was able to have, like, have a say, have an opinion, a valid opinion in so many different fields.
A valid Islamic opinion, yes. From the Quran, from the Ahadith, he was able to pass verdicts with certainty. There are very, very, very few.